Welcome to Better Together, a Vaishnava family podcast.
A podcast where we talk about family life from a bhakti yoga perspective. We are your hosts. I'm Aksh.
And I'm Gopika. Welcome to episode 7. Making Janmashtami matter for little kids. So it's August and Janmashtami is approaching, one of really the largest Vaishnava and I would even say Hindu holidays. And I think something that's on our mind this year, given that Kishore is edging on 4 years old and understanding so much more now. And I'm really thinking about how do we want to celebrate Janmashtami in our home and as a family this year? And does it really matter how we do it? I mean, our kids are still so little, or can we just kind of like slide by and do whatever? What do you remember about celebrating Janmashtami as a little kid?
Well, I remember it being hot,
yeah,
crowded, dark, a little loud, and I remember being hungry.
Yeah.
But when I did eat, the food was really, really good. And there was definitely a sense of festiveness. Fun and games and that sort of thing. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing that comes to mind was the fasting. Ironically, I feel like that was like a huge thing, you know, fasting from food and water the whole day. And it was like a challenge. Can you do it? But yeah, similar, going to temple, attempting to stay up until midnight. I have vague memories of actually falling asleep when I was really young. Like, I couldn't make it.
Yeah.
Just being, like, totally exhausted. I also remember being involved in something. Not as a super young child. As we got older, my parents were always doing something critical for the festival. You know, like, whether it came down to leading and cooking the feast or just everything. I mean, as a family, we would try to go to Mangalarti that morning. And then my parents would just kind of be busy at the temple. And so I also attempted to make myself busy. So Mangalarti is a service that happens super early in the morning. I remember actually one year where I went to Mangalarti with my parents, like 4:30 in the morning. And then after that, my parents were just busy. They like had different things they were doing at the temple, whether it was like altar seva, cooking. And I felt like I had nothing to do. I didn't know what to do. I felt a bit lost. And so then I kind of found my way to the kitchen and I ended up like manning the robotic chopper for 4 hours, cutting all the potatoes and the carrots and just like cauliflower. I mean, it was amazing, but I was just reflecting on how much I actually really needed engagement as a child because I felt lost. I almost was lacking some of that internal connection to the holiday in terms of, okay, yes, we're celebrating Krishna's birthday, but why does this actually matter to me?
That's a really nice point. When I think back to even as I got older, I also was engaged in various capacities, part of the CNJ temple community as it was just growing. And I was, you know, young adolescent, and there was a desire to put on this really big Janmashtami festival in these like rented halls where like hundreds of people would be coming. But, like, no one knew how to run a sound system at that scale. So I literally just had to figure it out. And I started becoming the default like AV person. And that's how I got into that seva. It actually started when I was 15, 16, 17. And it was started with these big festivals like Janmashtami every year.
Yeah.
It seems like now that I look back, based on what you just said, I'm realizing that was actually an important piece of it. And maybe something that I didn't realize.
Yeah. You were involved a lot. I mean, talk about engagement. Yeah. But it brings up this question for me, right? Like, we're talking about how our Janmashtamis as youth were primarily around having a role in some way. Like, that's what we needed. Can young children have a real deep spiritual connection? Or is it that we just have to engage them? keep them connected, make them feel valued, make them,
make it
you
fun.
Know, make it fun until they're old enough to then, you know, figure that deeper part out on their own. What do you think?
It's a really deep topic. When we look into it, there's something called faith development theory, which in the academic world is sort of a way to codify the different stages that an individual goes through as they grow and mature in their faith. And there's many different models, but maybe the most popular one is called the Fowler model, or developed by this person called James Fowler. And he has these stages. So stage zero is infancy and undifferentiated faith. So it's, they're the very beginnings of just forming a sense of trust with your environment and absorbing all those experiences.
So hold on. When you mean developing sense of trust and absorbing the experiences, what do you mean? Because I'm thinking about our kids who are in that stage.
Well, I can read a little bit of the summary of it. In the pre-stage called undifferentiated faith, the seeds of trust, courage, hope, and love are fused in an undifferentiated way and contend with senses of threats or of abandonment, inconsistencies, and deprivations in an infant's environment.
So I actually think this is important, right? Because when we think about balancing services with caring for our children,
yes,
it's easy to care for the baby. Just feed them, you change their diaper, they need to be held, and then I can continue my service doing whatever, whatever. And I know that for me, I always have this pull of like getting back to my life, you know? And I mean, what I'm hearing from this section actually is that even babies, although they can't communicate, they can't express, they absorb.
Yes.
This feeling of connection and trust and being prioritized in the environment, so that even when I do engage with my faith, like, I really have to think about how is my baby responding to my involvement.
Yeah. And I would even flip it to say that the baby's spiritual life begins from their experience of how their parent has engaged with them early on. Right. Yeah. So read this part. The emergent strength of faith in this stage is the fund of basic trust and relational experience of mutuality with the ones providing primary love and care.
Yeah. And obviously, again, this is tricky, right? It's going to be a tricky balance because parents need to be happy to provide a sense of relational trust and care. So you can't just like, if you have a service that really enthuses you, that really excites you, you can't just drop everything to be like your baby's number one. But I think it's just a really interesting point. And also thinking about how temples and centers accommodate babies. I mean, I know right now, slowly, slowly, with advocacy, when new temples are being built, there is some thought being given to a place to nurse for moms and a room for children to play. But honestly, in general, in our temples, it's like really difficult to care for little babies at festivals. So it makes you think about this because ISKCON is so concerned about the next generation. Who's going to carry the movement forward? And there's a lot of attention sometimes placed on older youth, which is also great. But, you know, starting from age zero, right?
Yeah.
Like it actually matters. They absorb these things.
So this is stage zero. Stage one is...
Now, in relation to our 3.5-year-old, I'm guessing.
Right, so stage one would go roughly from age 3 to age 6.
Okay.
So stage one, which is called intuitive projective faith, is this idea of like intuition. So they can't always articulate the idea or the concept, but they feel things intuitively. Stage one, intuitive projective faith, is the fantasy-filled, imitative phase in which a child can be powerfully and permanently influenced by examples, moods, actions, and stories of the visible faith of primarily related adults.
That's so interesting, because what I'm hearing there is that it's actually not about engaging them at a young age, but it's actually more about what they see in us. Like, parents were like, you know, they were super involved, which is amazing and wonderful. But also, like, it makes me think about how that might have imprinted me as a child. And then even as an adult, almost going to temple and always really needing something to do, otherwise feeling out of place. And then really having to look at that and confront that during COVID when all of that was taken away. And then I was like, wait a second, like, what is this really about anyway?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I guess the question is, like, can we ourselves model in a way that is also relevant and applicable to a younger child?
Yeah.
Right. Because if we're modeling in that way, in a way that a child can also relate to at least some elements of it, then what they're getting is a certain type of lens in which to apply their faith into their life.
Yeah. So can you give me an example of, you know, how you think you could model it in a way that would be understandable by these young children? What does it actually look like?
Well, what came to my mind was thinking about this framework of head, heart, and hands. Do you want to explain head, heart, and hands?
Yeah. A side project that we work on is Making Bhakti Matter. And over the course of the last decade plus, and reflecting on our own Krishna conscious experience and the experience of other second generation youth, we started to analyze what might be the spiritual needs of second generation Hare Krishna youth so that they can become adults with a real, genuine, authentic relationship with Krishna, not, you know, a sentimental, superficial one. Not that that is bad, but just really looking for like a connection that was one's own choice, and really distilling a lot of surveys and reflections and our own experience of working with second generation kids, we kind of found three major needs. So the head needs are the needs that actually involve this idea of relevance, and this idea of bhakti plays a role in my life in a way that's valuable. Like the principles and the tenets of bhakti will actually support me in my life. They're valuable to me, as valuable as math. The heart needs are kind of the relational needs. So this idea of really feeling connected to other people, having deep relationships with other people, true sangha, in which I can connect with you and we can share how Krishna shows up in our life, right? I feel supported by my community, whether or not or I choose to be part of Krishna consciousness or not. I feel loved and I feel supported. And then the hand needs are more this engagement, which is kind of what we were talking about, which I think dominated our childhood, making bhakti really joyful and fun and hands-on and being involved and service projects and outings, recreation. The point is that all three are actually important. The tendency is to focus on one or the other, whether it's heart or hands. Those two generally tend to be focused on most. And for little kids, hands, you know, like the crafts and the dramas and doing something and being part of something, right? And the need that actually gets ignored the most is the head needs,
yeah.
Which is like this idea of how is this valuable to me? How is this relevant to me?
Yeah. And head doesn't mean memorization.
I don't want to deny memorizing, because I do think that, you know, samskaras have impact in our consciousness, in our life, in our awareness. However, in our framework, we really think about this idea of value and connection to one's life. And so this head need is often most missed, most overlooked, especially for young children. I think most people feel like they're not even really capable of doing this work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Based off of faith development theory,
yeah,
and even other research that's being done in spirituality now, that really is arguing that a spiritual sense or a spiritual core is innate. As young children, they have some sense that there's something transcendent about the world and the way that we're connected to it and other creatures. I think the fun element is super important for young kids. There's no doubt about that. But I would argue that there's room for there to be some amount of head.
Yeah.
In even for young children, as young as really any age, but certainly 3 through 6, this stage that we're talking about. Like as we're discussing a story with a young child and we're maybe acting out the story or doing something fun with it, there's an opportunity to build in something that helps them connect to it in a way that it's real in their life. Maybe it's relating to Krishna as a friend and their idea of friends and what friends can do. So in terms of modeling, I was thinking of it in terms of head, heart, hands, because one of the ways that as a parent, I could try to help model it, particularly if it's going beyond the fun aspect and also including some head piece, is myself modeling and articulating like what Krishna has done for me in my life, right? Or how has he shown up? Or how do I experience him as a friend?
Yeah, that goes in line with Lisa Miller's research on spirituality and how actually what children need is validation of something that they actually feel inside.
Intuitively, yeah.
Yeah, they feel it intuitively. They don't have language for it. So they actually need models of how to express it. Talking about our spiritual experiences, times in our life where Krishna played a role or something very specific about Krishna that we appreciate could be really powerful. I actually loved that the research said that because I felt like it was so in line with bhakti philosophy that we believe that Krishna is a person, that God is a person. And if someone's birthday happens in our family, you know, what do? To celebrate them? Yeah. We try to share something that we appreciate about that person. And so if God is truly a person, he's supposed to be the closest person in our lives, just like a family member. It makes sense to me that then we should be sharing with each other in our family what we appreciate about God as a person on that day.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I love that example. And I was also thinking that we even see this in Bhagavatam. I still remember I read through verses in the first canto when Bhishma Dev is on the battlefield, on the bed of arrows. He's meeting Krishna for the last time before he departs. I kind of had some preconception of what I thought he was going to say after hearing so many prayers. Krishna, you're so great and this and that. Mm. But I was so struck as to how many verses in that section actually was just Bhishma Dev simply telling Krishna and expressing gratitude of times where Krishna showed up in his life specifically. Dear Lord, when this happened with the Pandavas, you were here. And then when this happened, you were here. And then when this happened, you were here. There was like verse after verse after verse. And I was just so struck. I was like, this guy is literally dying on the battlefield. So this is what it means to remember Krishna at the time of death. It's actually about Krishna in your specific life. It's not just some like, I'm thinking about Krishna as God in Vrindavan playing with the cows. That's a beautiful meditation. But actually, the powerful meditation is really, how is God showing up in my life? And so, yes, focusing on Krishna stories and the cows and the demons of Vrindavan and all of that, I think that is one important element. But I feel like not at the expense of actually the other component of Krishna in my life for younger children.
Yeah, yeah. It also reminds me there's something called the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, in which there's someone who's seeking spiritual experience and meets this person named Gopa Kumar, who then relays his own story. And in the very beginning of that section, it says, of all forms of evidence, one's personal experience is the most powerful.
Yeah. So what do we want to do as a family for Janmashtami after thinking about everything we just chatted about?
Well, for me, one of the things that I would love to do is have a strong focus on family connection and family time. I think there's a great value in going to the temple or be part of all these activities that are happening, the festiveness. But I think it could be supplemented a lot by grounding ourselves first as a family on what is this holiday and what does it mean to me? Rather than just sort of going with the motions of it being a festival, really starting with almost like a meditation on the festival, but, you know, age appropriate.
Which would look like what?
So right now, our son is in this stage where he's working through fears and developing more confidence. I was wondering if we focused on one story and just really tried to look at that from multiple angles. So the one that comes to my mind is the Agasura one, you know, because there's this element.
Agasura with great big teeth go chomp, chomp, chomp. Credit Tulsi. Amazing. Kids, Krishna conscious, songwriter, producer.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Absolutely.
I'm getting loopy because it's getting close to midnight. So yes, Agasura.
And there's many elements to that story, but, you know, one big one is just how his friends had this fearlessness about entering this cave, which they kind of already knew was a bit suspicious. But because they had Krishna as a friend, they had that confidence that they could walk through it.
Mm.
And I know it's a deeper concept. I'm not expecting that our son's going to understand the idea of a God being a friend and having your back exactly to that full extent. But I think it's a really interesting story where maybe we could pull at that a little bit.
Yeah, I do love your idea. I think it's very practical to think about a pastime or story of Krishna. And then as you're retelling the story, have the goal of not just sharing the story, but perhaps emphasizing or guiding a certain aspect of that story, right? Mm. So like the example you gave in Agasura, or I really love Sudama pastime, and like this idea of friendship. So thinking about a theme from the story that might resonate with your child, even if they're young and they can't articulate it. I love that idea. I also think just like having our own tradition as a family. So like going to the temple is part of it.
Yeah.
But also, you know, having a little birthday party at home, you know, blowing up some balloons and making something yummy for lunch, even though we're fasting technically, but our kids are not. So, you know, right? Like kind of treating it like a birthday so they understand this personal aspect of Krishna. Maybe making cards for Krishna and encouraging them to express something that they like about Krishna. Yeah. Even if it's one thing, yeah. Right? Engaging them in that way. And then, you know, if possible, I would love to do something with some of the other younger children at the temple for that heart aspect, right? So we talked about head, we talked about hands at home, but also like this idea of I have friends that also do this, that are also celebrating Janmashtami, that we all have fun together. Yeah. I don't feel like the temple event, especially for young kids, is really that experience because it's generally overwhelming and overstimulating.
Yeah.
But some sort of story time with songs and fun and just having fun together, like having this memory of that I experienced Janmashtami with other people my age. I think that's also powerful.
Yeah. I think we have our work cut out for us.
Yes, we definitely have our work cut out for us. Isn't it ironic that we are recording this podcast for Janmashtami, which centers around midnight, at midnight?
Oh, it's almost midnight.
It's almost midnight. but with that, time to sign off.
Yeah.
All right. So. Well, thanks for listening and joining us as we explore and navigate this whole, how can we raise our kids in Krishna consciousness, but also really cultivate a genuine, authentic love for bhakti. There are so many brilliant parents out there, and I would love to hear your ideas, your thoughts about how you are making Janmashtami celebratory and special and meaningful. But with that, wishing you a very happy Janmashtami, and we will see you in the next episode.
Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.